From the far end of the glass-topped counter, one of Aaron's shopmen gave Sybil the cold eye, standing haughty and tall in his neat black coat and polished boots. He knew something was up. He could smell it. Sybil waited for Mick to pay, hands folded before her on her skirt, demure, but watching sidelong from beneath the blue fringe of her bonnet. Under her skirt, wadded through the frame of her crinoline, was the shawl she'd nicked while Radley tried on top hats. Sybil had learnt how to nick things. She'd taught herself. It simply took nerve, that was the secret. It took pluck. Look neither right nor left, just grab, lift her skirt, stuff and rustle, then stand quite straight, with a psalm-singing look, like a gentry girl. The floorman had lost interest in her. He was watching a fat man fingering watered silk braces. Sybil checked her skirt quickly. No bulge showed. A young, spotty-faced clerk with ink-stained thumbs set Mick's number into a countertop credit machine. Zip, click, a pull on the ebony-handled lever, and it was done. He gave Mick his printed purchase slip and did the parcel up in string and crisp green paper. Aaron and Son would never miss a cashmere shawl. Perhaps their account engines would, when they tallied up, but the loss couldn't hurt them. Their shopping palace was too big and too rich. All those Greek columns, chandeliers of Irish crystal, a million mirrors, room after gilded room, stuffed with rubber riding boots and French milled soap, walking sticks, umbrellas, cutlery, locked glass cases crammed with silver plate and ivory brooches and lovely wind-up golden music boxes. And this was only one of a dozen in a chain. But for all that, she knew, Aaron's wasn't truly smart. Not a gentry place. But couldn't you just do anything with money in England, if you were clever? Some day Mr. Aaron, a whiskery old merchant Jew from Whitechapel, would have a lordship, with a steam gurney waiting at the curb and his own coat of arms on the coachwork. The Rad Parliament wouldn't care that Mr. Aaron was no Christian. They'd given Charles Darwin a lordship, and he said that Adam and Eve were monkeys. The liftman, gotten up in a Frenchified livery, drew the rattling brass gate aside for her. Mick followed her in, his parcel tucked under his arm, and then they were descending. They emerged from Aaron's into Whitechapel jostle. While Mick checked a street map he took from his coat, she gazed up at the shifting letters that ran the length of Aaron's frontage. A mechanical frieze, a slow sort of kinetrope for Aaron's adverts, made all of little bits of painted wood, clicking about each in turn, behind leaded sheets of bevel glass. "Convert your manual piano," the jostling letters suggested, "into a Kastner's pianola." The skyline west of Whitechapel was spiky with construction cranes, stark steel skeletons painted with red lead against the damp. Older buildings were furred with scaffolding. What wasn't being torn down, it seemed to make way for the new, was being rebuilt in its image. There was a distant huffing of excavation and a tremulous feeling below the pavement, of vast machines cutting some new underground line. But now Mick turned left without a word and walked away, his hat cocked to one side, his checkered trouser legs flashing under the long hem of his greatcoat. She had to hurry to match his step. A ragged boy with a numbered tin badge was sweeping mucky snow from the crossing. Mick tossed him a penny without breaking stride and headed down the lane called Butcher Row. She caught up and took his arm, past red and white carcasses dangling from their black iron hooks, beef and mutton and veal, and thick men in their stained aprons crying their goods. London women crowded there in scores, wicker baskets on their arms. Servants, cooks, respectable wives with men at home. A red-faced, squinting butcher lurched in front of Sybil with a double handful of blue meat. "Hello, pretty missus. Buy a gentleman my nice kidneys for pie." Sybil ducked her head and walked around him. Parked barrows crowded the curb where costers stood bellowing, their velveteen coats set off with buttons of brass or pearl. Each had his numbered badge, though fully half the numbers were slang, Mick claimed, as slang as the costers' weights and measures. There were blankets and baskets spread on neatly chalked squares on the paving, and Mick was telling her of ways the costers had to plump out shrunken fruit and weave dead eels in with live. She smiled at the pleasure he seemed to take in knowing such things, while hawkers yelped about their brooms and soap and candles, and a scowling organ grinder cranked two-handed at his symphony machine, filling the street with a fast, springy racket of bells, piano wire, and steel. Mick stopped beside a wooden trestle table, kept by a squint-eyed widow in bombazine, the stump of a clay pipe protruding from her thin lips. Arrayed before her were numerous vials of some viscous-looking substance Sybil took to be a patent medicine, for each was pasted with a blue slip of paper bearing the blurred image of a savage Red Indian. "What will this be, mother?" Mick inquired, tapping one red-waxed cork with a gloved finger.
"Rock oil, mister," she said, relinquishing the stem of her pipe. "Much as they call Barbados tar."
Her drawling accent grated on the ear, but Sybil felt a pang of pity. How far the woman was from whatever outlandish place she'd once called home.
"Really?" Mick asked. "It wouldn't be Texian." "Healthful balm," the widow said, "from nature's secret spring. The bloom of health and life to man will bring. Skimmed by the savage Seneca from the waters of Pennsylvania's great oil creek, mister. 3 pence is the vial and a guaranteed cure-all."
The woman was peering up at Mick now with a queer expression, her pale eyes screwed tight in nests of wrinkles, as though she might recall his face. Sybil shivered.
"Good day to you then, mother,"
Mick said, with a smile that somehow reminded Sybil of a vice detective she'd known, a sandy little man who worked Leicester Square and Soho. The Badger, the girls had called him.
"What is it?"
she asked, taking Mick's arm as he turned to go.
"What is it she's selling?"
"Rock oil," Mick said,
and she caught his sharp glance back at the hunched black figure.
"The general tells me it bubbles from the ground in Texas."
Sybil was curious.
"Is it a proper cure-all, then?"
"Never mind," he said, "and here's an end to chat."
He was glancing bright-eyed down the lane.
"I see one, and you know what to do."
Sybil nodded, and began to pick her way through the market crowd toward the man Mick had seen. He was a ballad seller, lean and hollow-cheeked, his hair long and greasy under a tall hat wrapped in bright polka-dot fabric. He held both his arms bent, hands knotted as if in prayer, the sleeves of his rumpled jacket heavy with long, rustling choirs of sheet music.
"Railway to heaven, ladies and gents,"
the ballad seller chanted, a veteran patterer.
"Of truth divine the rails are made, and on the rock of ages laid. The rails are fixed in chains of love, firm as the throne of God above. Lovely tune, and only tuppence, miss."
"Do you have The Raven of San Jacinto?"
Sybil asked.
"I can get that. I can get it," the seller said. "And what's that, then?"
"About the great battle in Texas. The great general?"
The battered seller arched his brows. His eyes were blue and crazily bright, with hunger, perhaps, or religion. Or gin.
"One of your Crimea generals, then? A Frenchie, this Mr. Jacinto?"
"No, no,"
Sybil said, and gave him a pitying smile.
"General Houston, Sam Houston of Texas. I do want that song most particular."
"I buy my publications fresh this afternoon, and I'll look for your song for you, sure, miss."
"I shall want at least 5 copies for my friends,"
Sybil said.
10 pence will get you 6.
6, then, and this afternoon at this very spot."
"Just as you say, miss."
The seller touched the brim of his hat. Sybil walked away into the crowd. She had done it. It was not so bad. She felt she could get used to it. Perhaps it was a good tune, too, one that people would enjoy when the ballad man was forced to sell the copies. Mick sidled up suddenly at her elbow.
"Not bad," Mick allowed, reaching into the pocket of his greatcoat, like magic to produce an apple turnover, still hot, flaking sugar and wrapped in greasy paper.
"Thank you,"
she said, startled but glad, for she'd been thinking of stopping, hiding, fetching out the stolen shawl. But Mick's eyes had been on her every moment. She hadn't seen him, but he'd been watching. That was the way he was. She wouldn't forget again. They walked, together and apart, all down Somerset, and then through the vast market of Petticoat Lane, lit as evening drew on with a host of lights, a glow of gas mantles, the white glare of carbide, filthy grease lamps, tallow dips twinkling among the foodstuffs proffered from the stalls. The hubbub was deafening here, but she delighted Mick by gulling 3 more ballad sellers. In a great, bright, Whitechapel gin palace, with glittering gold-papered walls flaring with fish-tail gas jets, Sybil excused herself and found a lady's convenience. There, safe within a reeking stall, she fetched the shawl out. So soft it was. And such a lovely violet colour, too, one of the strange new dyes clever people made from coal. She folded the shawl neatly and stuffed it through the top of her corset so it rested safe, then out to join her keeper again, finding him seated at a table. He'd bought her a noggin of honey gin. She sat beside him.
"You did well, girl,"
he said, and slid the little glass toward her. The place was full of Crimean soldiers on furlough, Irishmen, with street drabs hanging on them, growing red-nosed and screechy on gin. No barmaids here, but big, bruiser, bully rock bartenders in white aprons, with mill-knocker clubs behind the bar.
"Gin's a whore's drink, Mick."
"Everybody likes gin," he said, "and you're no whore, Sybil."
"Dolly Mop, Bobtail."
She looked at him sharply.
"What else do you call me, then?"
"You're with Dandy Mick now," he said.
He leaned his chair back, jabbing his gloved thumbs through the armholes of his waistcoat.
"You're an adventuress."
"Adventuress?"
"Bloody right," he straightened. "And here's to you."
He sipped his gin twist, rolled it over his tongue with an unhappy look, and swallowed.
"Never mind, dear. They've cut this with turpentine, or I'm a Jew."
He stood up. They left. She hung on his arm, trying to slow his pace.
"Adventurer. That's what you are then, eh, Mr. Mick Radley?"
"So I am, Sybil," he said softly, "and you're to be my prentice. So you do as you're told in the proper humble spirit. Learn the tricks of craft. And some day you join the union, eh? The guild."
"Like my father, eh? You want to make a play of that, Mick? Who he was? Who I am?"
"No," Mick said flatly. "He was old-fashioned. He's nobody now."
Sybil smirked.
"They let us wicked girls into this fancy guild of yours, do they, Mick?"
"It's a knowledge guild," he said soberly. "The bosses, the big uns, they can take all manner of things away from us, with their bloody laws and factories and courts and banks. They can make the world to their pleasure. They can take away your home and kin and even the work you do."
Mick shrugged angrily, his lean shoulders denting the heavy fabric of the greatcoat. "And even rob a hero's daughter of her virtue, if I'm not too bold in speaking of it." He pressed her hand against his sleeve, a hard, trapping grip.
"But they can't ever take what you know. Now can they, Sybil? They can't ever take that."
Sybil heard Hetty's footsteps in the hall outside her room and the rattle of Hetty's key at the door. She let the serenade die down with a high-pitched drone. Hetty tugged the snow-flaked woolen bonnet from her head, shrugging free from her navy cloak. She was another of Mrs. Winterhalter's girls, a big-boned, raucous brunette from Devon, who drank too much but was sweet in her way and always kind to Toby. Sybil folded away the china-handled crank and lowered the cheap instrument's scratched lid.
"I was practicing. Mrs. Winterhalter wants me to sing next Thursday." "Bother the old drab," Hetty said. "Thought this was your night out with Mr. C. Or is it Mr. K?"
Hetty stamped warmth into her feet before the narrow little hearth, then noticed in the lamplight the scattering of shoes and hat boxes from Aaron and Son.
"My word,"
she said, and smiled, her broad mouth pinched a bit with envy.
"New beau, is it? You're so lucky, Sybil Jones."
"Perhaps." Sybil sipped hot lemon cordial, tilting her head back to relax her throat. Hetty winked.
"Winterhalter doesn't know about this one, eh?"
Sybil shook her head and smiled. Hetty would not tell.
"Do you know anything about Texas, Hetty?"
"A country in America," Hetty said readily. "French own it, don't they?
That's Mexico. Would you like to go to a kinotrope show, Hetty? The former president of Texas is lecturing. I've tickets. Free for the taking."
"When?"
"Saturday."
"I'm dancing then," Hetty said.
"Perhaps Mandy would go."
She blew warmth into her fingers.
"Friend of mine comes by late tonight. Wouldn't trouble you, would it?"
"No,"
Sybil said. Mrs. Winterhalter had a strict rule against any girl keeping company with men in her room. It was a rule Hetty often ignored, as if daring the landlord to peach on her. Since Mrs. Winterhalter chose to pay the rent directly to the landlord, Mr. Cairns, Sybil seldom had call to speak to him, and less with his sullen wife, a thick-ankled woman with a taste for dreadful hats. Cairns and his wife had never informed against Hetty, though Sybil was not sure why, for Hetty's room was next to theirs, and Hetty made a shameless racket when she brought men home. foreign diplomats mostly, men with odd accents, and, to judge by the noise, beastly habits.
"You can carry on singing if you like," Hetty said, and knelt before the ash-covered fire. "You've a fine voice. Mustn't let your gifts go to waste."
She began to feed individual coals to the hearth, shivering. A dire chill seemed to enter the room then, through the cracked casement of one of the nailed-up windows, and for a strange passing moment Sybil felt a distinct presence in the air, a definite sense of observation, of eyes fixed upon her from another realm. She thought of her dead father.
"Learn the voice, Sybil. Learn to speak. It's all we have that can fight them," he had told her.
This in the last few days before his arrest, when it was clear that the Rads had won again, clear to everyone, perhaps, save Walter Gerard. She had seen then, with heart-crushing clarity, the utter magnitude of her father's defeat. His ideals would be lost, not just misplaced, but utterly expunged from history, to be crushed again and again and again, like the carcass of a mongrel dog under the racketing wheels of an express train.
"Learn to speak, Sybil. It's all we have."
"Read to me," Hetty asked. "I'll make tea."
"Very well." In her spotty, scattered life with Hetty, reading aloud was one of the little rituals they had that passed for domesticity. Sybil took up the day's Illustrated London News from the deal table, settled her crinoline about her in the creaking, damp-smelling armchair, and squinted at a front-page article. It concerned itself with dinosaurs. The Rads were mad for these dinosaurs, it seemed. Here was an engraving of a party of seven, led by Lord Darwin, all peering intently at some indeterminate object embedded in a coalface in Thuringia. Sybil read the caption aloud, showed the picture to Hetty. A bone. The thing in the coal was a monstrous bone, as long as a man was tall. She shuddered. Turning the page, she encountered an artist's view of the creature as it might have looked in life, a monstrosity with twin rows of angry, triangular, saw teeth along its humped spine. It seemed the size of an elephant, at least, though its evil little head was scarcely larger than a hound's. Hetty poured the tea.
"Reptiles held sway across the whole of the earth, eh?" she quoted, and threaded her needle. "I don't believe a bloody word of it."
"Why not?
They're the bones of bloody giants, out of Genesis. That's what the clergy say, ain't it?"
Sybil said nothing. Neither supposition struck her as the more fantastic. She turned to a second article, this one in praise of Her Majesty's artillery in the Crimea. She found an engraving of two handsome subalterns admiring the operation of a long-range gun. The gun itself, its barrel stout as a foundry stack, looked fit to make short work of all Lord Darwin's dinosaurs. Sybil's attention, however, was held by an inset view of the gunnery engine. The intricate nest of interlocking gearwork possessed a queer beauty, like some kind of baroquely fabulous wallpaper.
"Have you anything that needs darning?" Hetty asked.
"No, thank you."
"Read some adverts, then," Hetty advised. "I do hate that war humbug."
There was Haviland China from Limoges, France, Vin Mariani, the French tonic, with a testimonial from Alexandre Dumas, and descriptive book, portraits and autographs of celebrities, upon application to the premises in Oxford Street. Silver electro-silicon polish. It never scratches, never wears. It is unlike others. The New Departure bicycle bell. It has a tone all its own. Dr. Bailey's Lithia water cures Bright's disease and the gouty diathesis. Gurney's Regent pocket steam engine intended for use with domestic sewing machines. This last held Sybil's attention, but not through its promise to operate a machine at double the old speed at a cost of 1/2 penny per hour. Here was an engraving of the tastefully ornamented little boiler, to be heated by gas or paraffin. Charles Egremont had purchased one of these for his wife. It came equipped with a rubber tube, intended to vent the waste steam when jammed under a convenient sash window. But Sybil had been delighted to hear that it had turned Madame's drawing-room into a Turkish bath. When the paper was finished, Sybil went to bed. She was woken around midnight by the savage, rhythmic crunching of Hetty's bed springs.